Well, it's wonderful to be here and also to follow Jeanette, because I think a lot of what I have to say in my talk is really a series of footnotes to her talk. And it's delighted to also talk about some of our community archives that I've worked on, but then also just think about it more broadly and what it implies to create community archives. As Jeanette pointed out, a sort of permeability between the outside and the inside, between archives and the general public, I think is really key to probably my talk and to many of the talks today. I've really been pushing for this new term, maximal access, in recent years, because I really sort of grew up in the open access movement. It was a term that I became aware of probably 15 years ago that was clearly enabled by the really incredible digital technology and particularly the web. And open access was a nice term 15 years ago. It meant that we had materials that were in some physical location and we could use this new technology to bring them online and make them openly available. But we're more than a quarter century into the history of the web, and I think the term is now inadequate. If you think about the term open access, it is still it's inert. It says we have some stuff and we're going to open that stuff to you outside of our institution. It doesn't involve any of the things that Jeanette just talked about the interactivity between library and archives and the public. It doesn't involve any of the activities that would actually bring these materials actively to people. It doesn't involve them in the process of creating the archives, of participating in the archives, of deciding what goes into the archives. Open access doesn't really provide us the words, the grammar, the tools to bring libraries and archives to multiple kinds of audiences, because the people who took advantage of open access were people like me, traditionally trained historians, who were delighted that we didn't have to get on an airplane to go visit an archive somewhere. It was now online. That was extremely helpful to me. But many people do not even know where to find these materials, even if you put them online. Many people don't know how to bring them together or to use them or to understand what metadata is. So, maximal access, and this term that I would like to talk about for the next 15 minutes or so, is really an attempt to think about how we maximize the access to this stuff. Okay, it's online. That is wonderful. That is step one. What are steps 2 and 3 and 4 that we can do together? How can we bring this to audiences? And how can we have audiences actually participate in the creation of library and archives materials, community archives, and the like? So I've been a historian and I've been a librarian, but today, at least for the next 15 minutes, I'm going to be an economist and talk about the supply side of the materials that we bring online. But then, for most of my talk about the demand side, how we stimulate demand for the use and the creation of these materials, how we fill in gaps in the historical and cultural record, and think about the audience that is outside of this talk that wouldn't even think to come here on a Friday at all. What can we do to participate in them? How do I advance? Sorry. So this is where I work now. I'm very fortunate to be on the campus of Northeastern now, and this is Snell Library. And one of the first things I did when I joined Northeastern in the summer was just to get the stats of how many people visit this library. And it's almost 2 million people a year actually go in the doors of this library. We have had days this past month where 12,000 people have actually come into this library. And that is a wonderful problem to have. It's nice that people are still coming to the library. It's also a tremendous opportunity actually to put into the visual space of these students and staff and faculty and other researchers what we might have in the library that's a little bit more hidden, like in the archives. But even as we talk about a very trafficked library like Snell Library on the Northeastern campus, you should realize, and I'm sure you can intuit, that we have many more visitors to the library online. We probably have an order of magnitude larger traffic to library.northeastern.edu. We have students and researchers and faculty actually across the country and around the world. We have other people who want to visit our collections. So for many of those people, Snell Library and the library system at Northeastern is its digital presence. That is the library for those people. And of course, if we expand out our purview even farther, the library for many of those people is actually not just the resources at Northeastern. It's resources that are associated with Northeastern research. Resources. It is materials in other archives that they're using. At this point in 2017, the library and the archive are an ecosystem that people access, and they often do not make distinctions. And I think Jeanette started getting at this of, as she put it, a sort of a larger collection that community archives can create. Everyone is already operating in that ecosystem and sees our library as just one piece. It's not just itself. It's part of a social ecosystem. And so I was very fortunate, as Robert Darton talked about last night, to be a part of this project, the Digital Public Library of America. And it was trying to bring into being that very notion of libraries and archives in a social space. In fact, often when I went out as executive director to talk about DPLA, I would often start by saying that DPLA was as much a social project, a political project, as it was a technical project. I think people looked at it, and we had metadata people and librarians and software developers, and the staff was very oriented in a way that you could say it's a library and technology project. But no, it's actually a social project about connecting institutions together. And we wanted to bring together all kinds of material that often aren't in shared space. Many different item types that live together. Often you have an archive that focuses on text or photographic records or oral histories. All of these things would be part of the Digital Public Library of America. All of them would be in one virtual space to match actually the sort of mental projection that people were coming to about what a library and archive means today. So we were creating a social archive. One that brought together many different archives, made them sociable. The organization was founded to create the connective tissue between these different institutions, to synthesize them together, because we knew that records existed in multiple places, materials existed in multiple places. I would often go around the country and give talks, and I would bring up just the records that we had of a city that I was visiting. And then there's a little button at the bottom of DPLA that says, show me the institutions that have contributed one or more digitized materials for this city. And you'd open up that window, and there'd be hundreds of institutions from across the country for any city that you could imagine. I mean, here in Boston, there's probably 100,000 records of Boston, but they probably come from 300 or 400 institutions across the country. So the idea of a Boston archive suddenly becomes a synthesis of hundreds of archives that exist across the country and indeed around the world, because materials about Boston live in multiple places. So that supply side, just briefly, was in fact a key component of open access at DPLA as we started. We really focused on this network model of many nodes feeding into larger nodes, feeding into the sea that was the entirety of the Digital Public Library of America. Some people have seen this model on our site, but we had many partner institutions feeding into what we called service hubs in each state that would help bring together metadata and sometimes even store the digitized copies of these materials. And then we project that into the overall Digital Public Library of America. It helped to bring together institutions like these that do already existed or that were produced as in these various states to help to bring together institutions. Minnesota Digital Library, which has almost 200 small, often community archives, public libraries that have small records, a couple hundred records from their town, were brought together into a hundreds of thousands of items archive that then was fed into DPLA. So from small ponds to lakes to the ocean that was DPLA, It was a really terrific and I think very smart model for bringing these materials together, again, to create supply. You can see another bubble diagram similar to the UK. At this point, I believe there are 17.8 million items from 2,500 libraries, archives, museums, and historic sites. So this project has been an incredible success, and I was incredibly fortunate to be a very small part of it and a part of Bob's amazing vision for what this actually could be. But let me focus now actually on that demand side, because even in the early stages after launch of the DPLA, as I started to evangelize for the project, I would start hearing from people, even when we had 2 million items, or 4 million items, or 6 million items. That's nice. I would go give talks at, say, a public library, and an audience say, that's nice, but I have trouble finding materials, or what's here, or why isn't this material included in your archive? Very pointed questions that were, frankly, I should have gotten. They're tough, tough questions. And we do, in fact, now live in a time where there are materials that could be gathered that aren't being actively sought and that we need to go out and actively seek, especially born digital materials that may be lost. You know, the average email address has a half-life of 2 years. The average website is only around for 5 years. There are things that go away that we need to reach out and get. There are materials on people's hard drives and phones, which I want to talk about at the end, that will languish there unless we go out and get them. Because there will not be preservation by neglect. There will not be the steamer trunk or the shoebox in the attic that we can find in 100 years. We're not going to be able to pull out our little black rectangles and extract this material unless we work with people and communities to pull that material out and preserve it. So we started hearing this at DPLA, and we started a shift in 2015 where we set up focus groups to say, what can we be doing better to maximize the access? How can we actually get it into communities? How can we have communities feed into it? One of the first groups that we started to work with, and Bob Darton was really instrumental in this, is thinking about education. The educational world could use this material, but they're not finding it, they're not integrating it into syllabi, they're not getting it into classrooms from kindergarten through graduate school. So we set up and raised money for an educational division and people to work in this area. We brought in teachers at all levels. We brought in media specialists and librarians who work in public schools to say, what can we do better to maximize the access, not just have it out there on our site with millions of items and hope that people will search through that Google-style search box, but actually find ways to make it more usable. And what we ended up doing was actually involving these communities in the creation and curation of primary source sets to say, okay, if you want to study Reconstruction or the Civil Rights era, we are going to pick 30 wonderful materials from many different institutions that will be there for you as a teacher or as a student to find easily, to integrate into your courses. And as soon as we launched this program, our traffic surged by about 50%. We saw people coming in and using this material, and even better, writing to us and saying, hey, can you create other sets on this topic and that topic? And don't forget about this. And so we created a more permanent community of teachers and educators at all levels who would advise us on what we could do next. And this really blossomed out into a series of materials, primary source sets, in hundreds of topics. In fact, even though I've left, I know this is an ongoing process. I believe this fall they're adding another 30 or 50 of these primary source sets. So this curatorial activity, which is oftentimes community-driven, actually led to much greater use, much greater discovery of the materials to begin with. And it wasn't to the exclusion of the use of the giant sea of materials either. We had teachers who would come in and pull out, let's say, our civil rights collection and say, you know what, I'll use these materials, but I'll add in 30 more items from my town that I found in the collection. They personalized it. We also thought in turn about distribution channels. Again, I feel awkward talking like an economist, but I think it's helpful to think in this mindset for just a bit. How can we distribute our materials? Again, open access. Hey, we've got a website. We put it up on the website. Again, that's great. That worked in the 1990s and the first decade of this century. But now we've got to think about distributing it more widely to maximize access. So we started doing deals at DPLA to think about where audiences already were. We asked focus groups, where do you go right now? And they weren't going to DPLA, or they weren't going to library.northeastern.edu, or probably any of your sites. They were going, of course, to Google, and they were going to PBS, which receives traffic from about 5 million teachers and students every year. And so we started talking to PBS and said, hey, can we port some of our material to your site so that people can find it? And so we actually were able, through technological means, to port our DPLA primary source sets to PBS Learning Media, which receives those audiences, and to meet them where they were so they could discover our materials. So right now, you can go there. PBS did a great job in terms of tagging them with different things like appropriateness of grades, materials, metadata around these things. And also, they lived in a space that was there with PBS television shows and other materials that they created. So we weren't being tight-fisted with our material. We're saying, let it live in other places. Let the distribution channels have its material flow to areas where it will actually meet awaiting audiences, meet the demand where it is. We also, from the start, had an API, an application programming interface, which is just a fancy way of saying that we had technological means for people to synthesize DPLA materials into their own websites. So we had a developer, for instance, in the United Kingdom who created this site called Culture Collage. You can Google it and you'll find it. And materials can be pulled from Culture Collage from DPLA, again, using this technological means. So you can see here a search for New Orleans that pulls up a bunch of our thumbnails. If you click through on these things, you come to not the DPLA website, but straight to the archive that digitized and made this material available. So we act as a broker, as a middleman in this distribution, and get people to the material they're looking for. We have other libraries who we had created a little widget that allows you from other libraries to search the DPLA collection seamlessly within their library environment. So people who are going to library.northeastern.edu can also search DPLA. They can get the millions of materials that are at SNEL, but they also see the 18 million items that are at DPLA. Here is Indiana University, Purdue University of Indianapolis. With that widget. We have New York Public Library that on their digital collection site added a box to their item pages that allows you to find more like this, to take an item that's in NYPL and to find other related materials over in DPLA. So New York Public has been a great partner of DPLA, and the traffic is bi-directional between us, social libraries, social archives. It creates a demand and creates connections between these places where audiences actually are. We have groups that are taking large slices of the DPLA and creating entirely new topic-based search engines. University of Minnesota has curated, I think this is a little bit old slide, I think they have over 500,000 materials from 1,000 US archives, libraries, and museums around African American history, largely pulled from DPLA's database, pulling this together for a more curated topical search as well. returning to the physical. What I love about right over the auditorium where Robert Darnton spoke last night, there's this great new entryway to the Boston Public Library that helps to capitalize on the foot traffic that comes into the library and alert them to digital materials. And my lead slide was one of these. There's actually a set of screens in the back that show all the digitized materials from Digital Commonwealth, that materials actually digitized in the basement where DPLA was co-located with the Internet Archive and BPL's own digital group. As they're digitizing materials, they can appear on these screens, they're actually touch screens. And you'd see, for instance, classes come in to the library and run right up to these screens and pull up a 300-year-old map of what was Copley Square, or the marsh that was Copley Square, and see what was around them, what was there. We have people pulling up materials on cell phones. And I think this is another area on the demand side that we have not adequately addressed. We've all got fancy laptops. I see a bunch open in this room. But most of the world is actually on cell phones. There's a billion of these things in places like Africa, where they have just completely missed the desktop and the laptop world, and they've gone straight to a single device. But they are getting access in places like Africa, even in some of the poor countries. You'd be amazed at how many people have access to this device. What are we doing to shoehorn our materials into this interface? What are we doing to take advantage of the billions of people who have this device but not a laptop, so that they can participate in the creation of archive and libraries? This is an untapped part of both the supply and the demand side that I think is worth considering today and in future days. Finally, I want to talk about rights and their role. Another aspect of our self-reflection at DPLA, and something that I continue to think about, is how rights both help and hinder maximizing access to materials. When we launched, we had thousands of different rights statements in DPLA. And if you let the general counsel of your institution write the rights statement for your archival material, you should expect a different outcome than if you are interested in maximizing access, because they are there to minimize risk, not maximize access. And while we need to obviously respect copyright, there are many things that we can do to incrementally increase access, to incrementally increase the ways that people can use this materials to stimulate demand. We have the possibility, the people in this room have the possibility, when they put things online, to make more liberal rights statements, to push for maximal use rather than just openness on our site. At DPLA, we have these item level pages, but actually DPLA is this ugly stuff under the hood. That's all it is. It's a bunch of text. It's a bunch of metadata, 17.8 million records of metadata that's ingested and normalized from 2,500 institutions. But one of the things that was really critical from the start is to make all the metadata CC0. So Creative Commons zero license means vaya con Dios. Do with this what you want. Take our metadata, use it in whatever way you want. We have the API that I mentioned. We have bulk downloads of all of our data from all of our institutions. And we work for rights clarification. And what that means is, when there was the thawing of relations with, for instance, Cuba, the Cuban National Library took our metadata, they actually used our bulk download, brought the metadata to Cuba, and they hadn't done a lot of digitization in Cuba. They had just done the card catalog. They have not started to digitize the books in the Biblioteca Nacional. They took DPLA's metadata and they integrated it with their online card catalog. I mean, it's actually an incredible artifact here, as you can see. But as you leaf through that card catalog, there's actually a button for DPLA. And if you click on that button, it actually pulls up a record related to that card in the Cuban National Library so that people can find an open access version of the text so that they don't need to digitize this book. It's available at Harvard, thanks to Bob and others. And the Cuban National Library is, in a sense, already beginning to digitize because it's been socialized with the DPLA and with America's collections. But that's also enabled at the root level by the rights around the metadata and the rights around the works themselves. Rights statements need to be clarified. We worked with our friends at Europeana, Knight Foundation, and Creative Commons to set up rightsstatements.org. I'll let you surf that in a break. But this is a place that is makes it clearer how our audiences can use the material. So we have different categories of rights statements, again, respecting copyright, but making it clear when an item is under copyright, but also making it clear when an item is not under copyright, which for the average member of the general public, they cannot figure this thing out. They cannot scroll down a page and read the language from a general counsel and understand, can I use this in a report? Can I publish it online? Can I repurpose it for a work of art? It's confusing. So we made these things more clear as rights statements in a similar way to Creative Commons. It actually uses some of the Creative Commons licenses, which are not statements. Those are licenses, but these are clearer statements. And that means that every work that gets pulled up in the DPLA will ultimately be able to be assessed for maximal use. What is the widest range of uses that we can have for this item? Community involvement. I will end with a footnote to Jeanette's great talk. It is really critical. We have the way now, again, to be bi-directional with our libraries and archives. Open access, again, is in its name, is unidirectional. But in focusing on maximal access and on the demand side, we can have interactions. Trove, the Digital Library of Australia, has done this for years. They started with their digitization project of their newspapers, and they've had thousands of people make millions and millions of text corrections to their online newspapers. So people go in, they find an article about their family or the sports event. Here's one where there's people who are obsessed with the dog races in Australian history. And there's someone who's done, I think, close to 2 million edits on dog racing. This is one to change the name of different dogs so that the historical record is correct. It's their fun way in retirement to make sure that we have all of this data, and that is completely legitimate. It's not what I study as a historian, but dog racing is there. Maybe more seriously, there's a lot of people who are interested in family history, which I think we consider a kind of notch down from academic history, but this is so important for the general public. On Trove, people go in all the time to correct obituaries, for instance, of relatives, make sure that the spelling is correct, which of course then makes it more searchable to maximize discovery and to maximize access. At Northeastern, we've worked on community archives. We have one on the Lower Roxbury Black History Project, and as Jeanette pointed out, these can be different kinds of artifacts. The Lower Roxbury Black History Project focused on oral histories. And Northeastern University Libraries acted to provide infrastructure and some staff, but we let this to be driven by the community, by members of the community, to be curated on site. And so it was about a kind of bi-directional interaction with them. Finally, we have a chance to roll this all together in 2017. We can have community archives. We can have our institutional archives. We can have broad-based aggregators like DPLA. We can have smaller regional things. We are working with members of the Boston Library Consortium on a Boston desegregation project that is digitizing records related to the desegregation of the Boston Public Schools, which, as you know, is a very difficult a period of time in the city. We wanted not just the formal records of the city, but community archives, materials that people might have Those are being digitized. I think we have about 3,000 of these community documents at Northeastern, but there are thousands others at Boston Public Library, at BU, at other places that are being synthesized together. We're actually using the infrastructure of DPLA to help bring it together technologically, but also as a platform to interact with our neighborly communities to make sure that this record of history and culture is full and complete, but also maximally used. Thank you very much.